Hello, VetBlast podcast listeners. Did you know that you can earn 0.25 CE credits with this podcast? After listening to this podcast, head on over to dvm360.com/flex and then sign in or register for a free account. Then select the podcast and follow the online prompts to claim your CE.
Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. Hey, what's in a number? We're going to be chatting how a clinical pathologist approaches results. Thank you to our friends at Zoetis for supporting this great conversation. And joining us is the one and only Dr. Carolyn Grimes. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So to our listeners, a little bit of information about our great colleague. Dr. Grimes earned her BS in biology from the University of Notre Dame in 2001, then her DVM from Purdue University in 2006. She completed a rotating internship in small animal medicine and surgery at Angel Animal Medical Center in Boston in 2007, then practiced for 2 years as a small animal emergency vet at Red Bank Veterinary Hospital. She completed a residency in clinical pathology at the University of Tennessee, then joined the faculty at the University of Montreal, where she worked in the clinical laboratory, taught veterinary curriculum, and did research that focused mainly on hematopathology and optimization of hematology analyzers. In 2017, she left the frigid north and worked for Ethos Diagnostic Science as the director of the San Diego Laboratory until this lab was acquired by Zoetis in 2020. Dr. Grimes has served several roles in Zoetis Diagnostics and now the Senior Medical Director of Diagnostic Laboratory Services. Her professional passions include quality assurance, laboratory management, hematology, and education. And in her free time, she enjoys reading, CrossFit, swimming, bird watching, spending time with her husband and two young boys, and rooting for the Red Sox. She and her family moved to the New Hampshire area in 2020, where she enjoys exploring the seacoast and in the winter, complaining about the cold. Huh? Did you have a rough winter there?
We didn't have a rough winter, but we're having a rough nor'easter right now.
It's making up. Mother Nature did not get
exactly
the memo on that. Okay, so like we were talking about, Dr. Grimes, we're talking about, you know, how a clinical pathologist approaches numeric laboratory results. So first of all, why is that important? And second, what is different about how a clinical pathologist looks at numbers as compared to how most vets in the clinic typically look at result numbers?
Yeah, it's a great question. And laboratory test results affect up to 60 to 70% of clinical decisions in human medicine. In our experience in veterinary medicine, it feels quite similar. It's easy to look at a number, a result number, and view it as a hard and precise data point. It's really comfortable to do that. So, for example, if your reference interval for glucose is 65 to 125 mg per DL and your patient's result is 130, it's natural to think, hey, this glucose result is high or the patient is hyperglycemic. And if your next patient's result is 120, to then conclude the glucose is normal or the patient is euglycemic. It's also natural to conclude that the patient with the 130 result has a higher glucose level than the patient with the 120 result. And while that may be true, there are actually many more factors to consider when looking at a number. It's not quite as easy as taking it at its face value.
Okay, so what factors are you talking about there? Can you expand a little on that?
Sure, of course. The most obvious thing that affects a glucose result, for example, is what's going on in the patient, meaning like what's the true circulating glucose concentration in the serum at the time that the sample is collected. This is ultimately the information that we're after and can be informed by pancreatic, metabolic health, recent meal intake, dextrose therapy, et cetera.
Gotcha. Well, I think that's what most people are focused on when we're looking at a numeric result, right? But you're saying there's more to it than that. So are you talking about how we transport and store the sample?
Yeah. And those are great examples of things that can significantly affect a number and make it less discrepant from its true value. Factors that can affect analytes during transportation and storage are hugely important. Glucose, as we know, can decrease if we wait too long to separate a patient's serum, the sample serum from its cellular component of the blood in a quick enough time frame. Some analytes may degrade if exposed to light, if they're stored for too long before they get on the instrument, if they're not kept at the right temperature, things like that. And many clinicians aren't even preparing the samples themselves. They may have a technician or assistant collecting and preparing the sample. They may not be aware of how long it was before it was put in the fridge, whether it was shipped on an ice pack, whether it was spun down or not. Even if they did prep the samples themselves, by the time they're receiving the results or are able to review the results, they may not have those details of the sample's journey front of mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's so many factors that go into this. And, you know, I'll get reports that'll say hemolysis, icterus, or lipemia. So how does that affect results and how significant is that effect?
Yeah, and interference is hugely important. The most common interference, as you mentioned, are hemolysis, lipemia, and icterus. But there are others, such as certain drugs or their metabolites, that can also interfere with the result.
All right, so that makes sense. So if one of these interferences is present, I should assume that all the analytes on my report are affected. So can you apply a correction factor or something to account for the change?
Oh, that's such a great question and something that's not widely understood. Unfortunately, it's not quite that straightforward. It really depends on the lab or instrument that you're using. So instruments perform a separate assay for each individual analyte, and a distinct chemical reaction is used to measure each analyte. Not all tests use the same methods to measure each analyte, and the nature and degree of the interference is different from method to method. So take creatinine, for example. Icterus may artifactually increase creatinine in the lab that you're used to, but a different lab that uses a different instrument or method to measure creatinine may actually have the opposite effect. Icterus may artifactually decrease creatinine in that lab. Or lipemia may have a minimal effect on an analyte in one lab and may significantly interfere with measurement of that same analyte in another lab. So when we're looking at results, it's really important to use laboratory-specific guidance when trying to determine if results might be artifactually altered, especially if you're looking at a result that doesn't seem to make sense in the patient's clinical picture. It's really, really important to consider any medications, supplements, unusual foods or treats that could alter results. Some medications may truly alter values, for example, how corticosteroid therapy will elevate ALP values. And some medications might cause artifactual alterations, like how potassium bromide will falsely elevate chloride levels.
Oh, so interesting. And then on top of that, there are also important factors related to the individual patient, right? So can you talk a little bit more on that?
Yeah, of course. So most of us are familiar with breed-specific variations. For example, how greyhounds typically have higher hematocrits or higher creatinine levels relative to other dogs. In a perfect world, you would have reference intervals specific for all different breeds, sex, and life stages. But that's just not a realistic undertaking in veterinary medicine. Beyond breed, though, we need to consider biologic variation, including variation that exists within or across a population, and variation that exists within a patient for a given analyte. So variation within a population can be thought of as variation in baseline values. Take a reference interval for BUN that's like 10 to 30 mgs per DL, and consider two healthy patients. So patient A may have a baseline BUN of 10, and patient B could have one that's 30. If patient A's BUN jumps to 30, so from the baseline of 10 up to 30, that might signal pathology in that patient, even though the result is still within the reference interval, and even though that value is the same as patient B, who is healthy. So that's what we mean by between-patient variation, and that's the variation within a population. But there's also within-patient variation. Albumin, for example, tends to be relatively steady in healthy patients from day to day or 1 week to the next, whereas another analyte like triglyceride may vary from day to day.
Interesting. So how can we know what the variation within patients and within populations is for an analyte?
So there's an excellent and free resource for this, actually. It's called Vet Biological Variation, and it could be accessed at vetbiologicalvariation.org. It's an independent, non-for-profit website that has been established by a cross-disciplinary committee of veterinary clinical pathologists, internists, and epidemiologists. That being said, I don't think it's reasonable or necessary for clinicians to consult specific variation when interpreting every result. It's more important to just be aware that this variation exists in order to get a better sense of the significance of a result relative to reference interval limits and relative to serial measurements or trending. In fact, biologic variation is used to determine guidelines for how much variation an instrument is, quote, allowed to have for a given analyte.
Instruments. Okay, cool. So what do you mean by that? Instruments are allowed to have variation.
I think this is a really key point and something to which most clinicians don't have a lot of exposure or training. It's not that we want to allow variation. It's simply that there are limitations to our technology and how precise and accurate we can be when measuring analytes. If you take a sample with a known concentration of something, let's use glucose again, and you run that sample on the best instrument in the world in a controlled environment, and you do it 20 times in a row, you're not going to get the same exact value on every single run. So if the true known value or target value is 100, you may get a range of values that is, say, between 90 and 110, and that's in a perfectly controlled environment for 20 consecutive runs. Add in the variability of the humidity and temperature of the environment, variations in the technician running the sample, how the sample was collected, things like that, and you introduce even more variability. The American Society of Veterinary Clinical Pathology has a Quality Assurance and Laboratory Standards Committee that has issued guidelines for how much variability an analyzer is allowed to have. And this is called allowable error. What they've done is essentially consider biologic variation, limitations of the technology, and the impact of variation on medical decision-making to create guidelines around how much variation is acceptable for each analyte. So, for example, the allowable error for chloride is set at 5%, and the allowable error for creatinine is 20%.
I did not know that, actually. So each laboratory has to prove that it meets these guidelines before running patient samples?
Well, sort of. And this is another really important point. So human diagnostic laboratories are required by federal and state laws to meet these kinds of quality standards. They are inspected by the federal government or an accrediting body. And if they don't meet the requirements, they are not legally allowed to run patient samples. And although the ASVCP, the American Society for Veterinary Clinical Pathology, has published some guidelines for quality programs, adherence to these guidelines is not mandatory in veterinary laboratories. And establishment of these guidelines in vet med, it's a relatively new endeavor. So the ASVCP's guidelines are not nearly as comprehensive as those guidelines in human medicine. So it's really up to each diagnostic lab to set their own set of quality standards and to determine how they will ensure that those standards are met. In short, it's really important that you trust your lab or ask them about their quality standards.
Trust the lab, ask about quality standards. Okay, so we've covered all sorts of factors that can influence an analyte's result beyond what is actually happening with that analyte in the patient. So now, what about reference intervals? So how do they play into interpretation of results?
Right. The reference intervals that we're used to in veterinary medicine are called population-based reference intervals. Population-based reference intervals generally represent the results expected in 95% of healthy animals in a given population. They're different from subject-based reference intervals, which would look at what is normal for a single individual over time. We generally use population-based reference intervals in vet med. This is in part because of convention and convenience. Many patients that present don't even have a single baseline data point, much less longitudinal data, sufficient to create like a whole reference interval just for that individual. But that's not to say that population-based reference intervals aren't important or helpful. In fact, depending on the biologic variation of a given analyte, a population-based reference interval might even be better. So in any case, we need to understand the limitations of the reference interval that we're using to interpret results. A population-based reference interval is the set of values that, again, represents results for 95% of healthy animals. You could make the reference interval more narrow or strict, but then you'd have more false positives, meaning more animals whose values in health would fall outside of the reference interval and be flagged as high or low. Similarly, if you make the reference interval too broad, you're going to start to have too many false negatives. Animals whose values in sickness would fall inside the reference interval and not be flagged as abnormal. But inherent to how these reference intervals are made, you will have animals that in health will be towards the very low end or even lower than the lower limit, of the reference interval, and in early stages of illness, this value may increase significantly, but not enough to fall higher than the upper limit of the reference interval. And another important thing to understand about reference intervals, which I hope makes sense now that we've talked about biologic variation and analytic variation, is that reference intervals can and should vary from lab to lab. The best reference intervals are as specific as possible to your patient, their breed, what they eat, where they live in the world, and also specific to your lab, to its environment, the analyzers and reagents they're using, the quality procedures, how they store and process samples. Two labs using different chemistry analyzers may have significantly different reference intervals, and it can be dangerous to assume that reference intervals from one lab can be used to interpret results from another lab.
So fascinating. I never knew this. This is so interesting. And it sounds like so many things go into what seems like a straightforward, simple number. So how do you recommend clinicians approach their lab results given all these factors?
Yeah, I don't know if people are going to believe me, but I really don't want to overcomplicate it. I just hope clinicians can appreciate that there are a lot of factors that can influence results. And it's worth double-clicking on those numbers, especially if they are borderline or if they don't make sense clinically. Just ask yourself, how confident am I that the number I am seeing is a true reflection of what's going on in the patient? And if you have a tricky case or your intuition is telling you that something is off or hidden, ask yourself, okay, was the sample collected and stored optimally, or do I even have that information? Is there any known interference, as in lipemia, icterus, or hemolysis? Could there be any unknown interference? Is the patient on any medications or supplements? Is there anything special or unusual about its diet? Is there anything special about the breed? And do I have baseline values for this patient for comparison? Also, what I like to do is imagine little confidence intervals around a result. So if ALT activity is 150 units per liter today and 180 the following week, it's easy to think, uh-oh, this value increased 20% over a week, this disease is progressing. But remember that there is normal biologic variation and also analyzer variation, which could mean this change is virtually meaningless. This is especially important when the result spans a medical decision limit, whether that's a reference interval limit, like IRIS staging guidelines, or a decision about whether it's safe to administer a drug like chemotherapy or something like that.
This is fantastic, Dr. Grimes. We've never had any of this conversation on the podcast, and I don't know if I've ever seen it in any conferences, but this really opened up my eyes. Thank you so much for sharing this with us and to the listeners. This is wonderful.
Oh, I'm so glad to have the opportunity to talk about this. It's something near and dear to my heart and something that I know that we don't get a lot of training in. So
I could tell. I could feel it. That's excellent. Thank you so much again for being here. And thank you to our friends at Zoetis for supporting this great conversation. And don't forget to rate this podcast. It always helps us out as we continue to grow. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.